Lab reactors are vessels of discovery. Inside these enclosed glass systems, chemical and biological reactions happen. Useful for developing many products, including medications like cancer drugs, they can also be used to produce these products on a small scale. A lab reactor is basically a sophisticated blender. During mixing, it also heats or cools ingredients to start a chemical reaction, and there are ports for attachments like a condenser. Making lab reactors starts with solid glass rods. The rods are sometimes a bit crooked, so a worker heats and moves them across rollers to straighten them. Grinding wheels round their shape to more precise contours, and a wet sanding smooths the surface. The operator measures the outer diameter of each rod. A worker heats one end of the rod and forms a rim using a special tool. He applies dabs of liquid glass just below the rim. This creates nubs for properly situating the blade hub on the main shaft. To make the reactor's inner wall, he scores a wide glass tube and exposes the score line to a flame and then water. Another worker heats the top end. He supports the glass with a wide paddle until it's malleable enough to shape. A forming tool gives it a wide lip that will serve as the opening of the reactor. He aims a flame at the newly formed flange to smooth out any imperfections. He slides a larger glass vessel over the flask, then fuses them at both ends. This creates a hollow jacket through which liquids will be pumped to heat or cool the contents of the flask. A different worker cuts another glass tube to length. He scores it lightly and again exposes it to fire and water to break it along the etched line. He shapes the tube into a port for the outside of the reactor jacket. He'll make two of these ports. They'll be used to circulate heating and cooling liquids. Using the torch, a worker softens a spot on the reactor jacket. With tweezers, he pulls away the softened glass, creating a hole for the port to be installed. After inserting a ceramic holder in the port, he fuses it to the hole on an angle. Once the seam solidifies, the port will be an intrinsic part of the lab reactor vessel. Abrasive wheels grind another glass tube to make it perfectly round. This tube will be part of a drainage valve. An employee then begins work on the rest of the drainage valve assembly. He forms an internal thread for a plug. And after cutting it shorter, another worker creates a flange on the other end. He burns a hole in the side of the valve tube. The drainage tubing, now also cut shorter, is ready to be attached to the rest of the valve. He heats the connecting points, and they melt and meld together. Since we last saw it, the reactor vessel has received a base. A worker burns a hole in that base and fuses the drainage valve onto it. Another employee then places the reactor vessel in a special fixture and checks that it sits level. She adds specific amounts of water incrementally, beginning with 2 cups. She draws a line on the outside of the reactor vessel to indicate the amount inside. This will provide a reference for affixing a scale. A lab reactor needs sturdy impeller blades to generate an effective chemical reaction. An automated milling tool cuts a notch in a disc made from strong, chemically resistant plastic. Another system carves screw threads into a hub made of the same material. A tool bores a hole in the center for the insertion of what's called the agitator shaft. The operator smooths the threads with fine sandpaper and then assembles the blades to the hub. Next is the condenser. It's an attachment through which vapor will travel to be transformed into a liquid. The worker twists the softened glass tube around a rod to form the coil. Another worker inserts a linear glass tube in the center of the coil. She melts glass near the bottom to seal the center tube to the coil. Moving to the top, she heats the glass and with tweezers, pulls a bit from the end of the coil to pry it open. With a pick, she opens it up a little more. She uses a graphite reaming tool to shape the glass opening into a more flared profile. The condenser body takes shape, and the worker forms a joint on the end. He inserts a standard joint to test the fit. The coil can now be inserted into the condenser body. Another worker fuses the condenser wall to the coil and burns holes in the glass wall to connect hose attachments. She exposes the seam to a less focused flame to bring down the temperature slowly. The next worker creates a joint for the lower end of the condenser. This joint will be used to connect the condenser to the reactor. Once the basic taper profile has been achieved, grinding tools size it more precisely. When the connector joint has been cut to length, the worker attaches it to the base of the condenser. Another glass fabricator makes more joints, one of which will connect the condenser to the reactor lid, or head as it's known in the industry. He keeps the glass tube long for easy handling, and then cuts it to the correct length. The worker now seals the center joint to a hole in the reactor lid. He burns holes in the reactor head for other connectors. As the glass balloons up, he pulls it away to fully open the hole. With all the connectors fused to the reactor head, a worker grinds the base of its flange against an abrasive wheel to make it perfectly even. An employee then applies decals to the head. These indicate the brand and the connector size. The decals will be baked into the glass during its final heating. He places all the parts in the annealing oven. The temperature gradually ramps up to 1040 degrees Fahrenheit and slowly cools. This final annealing removes internal stresses and strengthens the glass. An inspector scrutinizes the head with a tool to confirm that the connector joints are in proper alignment and positioned at the correct angle. Workers install the vessel on a stand, insert the shaft and blades, attach the head, and connect the condenser. Pressed glass originated in 19th century America and England, and it revolutionized glassware. It offered the look of crystal on a budget, adding elegance to a humble meal. It became known as poor man's crystal. Today, this affordable glass still has class. Pressed glass or cut crystal. Invented in the 18th century, pressed glass can still impress company and keep them guessing. Pressed glass ingredients include lime, sodium nitrate, soda ash, silica sand, mineral or chemical colorants, and leftover or rejected glass from the factory. They melt the ingredients in a furnace heated at over 2900 degrees Fahrenheit. A worker twirls a rod with a ceramic ball on the end into it, and the hot liquid glass clings to it. Then it's ready for transfer to the iron mold. When the mold is partly full, a worker snips the liquid glass with scissors to cut the flow. He places a ring with pegs on the rim to align the mold with a plunger. He lowers the plunger and applies physical pressure to a lever to squeeze the glass into every crevice. This transforms the glass blob into a berry bowl with elaborate impressions on the outside. As it cools, the bowl hardens just enough to be extracted, but it's still quite soft. Careful to not distort the shape, he transfers the bowl to two bricks. A hose below the bricks pumps air to cool the glass further. Over a period of 4 hours, the team makes 250 berry bowls. Some of the bowls will be flattened to turn them into dessert plates, while others will be worked into the shape of candy baskets. Once the glass is firmed up enough, the bowls take a couple of trips through the glazer. First upside down, and then right side up. A gas flame melts the outer layer of the glass to make it shine both inside and out. He clamps the bowl onto the end of a rod called a snap and places it into a second, smaller furnace briefly. This softens the glass to prepare it for another transformation. Still clamped on the rod, a worker spins the bowl. With a stick of wood, he applies pressure to the upper part to flatten and flare it out. He then draws the piece between two pipes to bend the sides upward. The pressed glass berry bowl has now become a candy basket. But baskets need handles, so it's back to the furnace to gather more glass. He collects a little less this time. He moves the molten glass around on a metal table to roll it longer. He inserts it in a mold that gives the glass a rib pattern. He heats the glass in the furnace one more time. Soft and sticky, the glass handle adheres to the basket. He pulls the handle longer as he twirls the basket, and then attaches the other end of the handle to it. The handle is a bit saggy, so before it cools, he improves the shape using an iron roller. As he works the glass, he pulls the handle up and makes it more well-rounded. Unclamped from the gathering rod now, he smooths the outer surface of the handle and tweaks its shape until satisfied. Using a torch, he melts the glass a bit where the handle meets the basket to improve the adhesion. And now it's over to the oven. Here, the pressed glass is heated and then cooled to room temperature over a period of 3.5 hours. This gradual heating and cooling is critical. It releases stress in the pressed glass to make it less likely to shatter. For generations, molds have been used to mass-produce pressed glass pieces that can look like expensive crystal. With all that practice, they have this down to a fine art. Some works are reproductions of vintage pieces. Others are new patterns. The appeal is timeless. Pyrex is an idea cooked up by the wife of a glass industry scientist in 1913. She believed the tough glass used in lantern globes would be great for baking cakes in. So she baked one in some glass her husband brought home. The cake was a hit, changing the notion that glass was too fragile for the oven. Today in most homes, you'll find different types of cookware, many of which are made from Pyrex. To produce some dishes, a batch feeder pushes ingredients into a big furnace as they spill out of a bin overhead. Silica sand is the biggest part of the mix. It's a crystalline substance and it makes glass transparent. The batch also includes soda ash and recycled glass. Some of the other ingredients are a trade secret. The furnace heats the mix to the melting point, over 2700 degrees Fahrenheit. It turns into molten glass that looks like lava. The glass in this lava-like form will spend up to 24 hours in the furnace. On its way out, mechanical shears cut it into gobs. The gobs slide down a water-cooled chute and drop into a baking dish-shaped mold. There are 16 molds on a rotating table. As it turns, the table delivers the gob-filled molds to a plunger, which presses them into the baking dish shape. Continuing to rotate, the table positions the molds under blowers. They cool the freshly molded glass so it holds its shape. A mechanical arm suctions up the glass dish and sets it down on another revolving table. Flames lick the glassware from burners above and below. The dish is exposed to a temperature of over 1800 degrees Fahrenheit. This softens its sharp edges so that the rim is smooth. Next, hoses blast high-pressure air, cooling the dishes to solidify them so that a mechanical arm can pick them up without ruining them. It transports the glass dishes to a conveyor belt. Further down, another arm feeds the dishes to a kiln, where heating and cooling cycles temper the glass. This is what gives Pyrex its strength. Now it's time to make the lid. A different plunger presses glass gobs into a lid shape. Every lid needs a knob, so a valve inside the mold forms it, and then thrust the lid up to be picked up by a mechanical arm. The arm flips its lid and sets it down on a conveyor belt. The lids are on the move, traveling through a tempering kiln. On their way out, a fan cools them off so that they can be handled by human hands this time. Workers inspect each glass lid before packing them. On another line, measuring cups are produced. Little platforms lift the measuring cups to suctioning arms that protrude from a revolving silkscreen machine. A little squeegee forces enamel through a screen, printing measurements onto the cup. Over in the lab, a worker roughs up a sample dish. By rubbing it with sandpaper, he mimics years of wear and tear. But it's about to be subjected to even more abuse. He places a sharp tool in the center of the dish and takes aim with a hammer. Will it break without shattering into numerous little shards? It's a clean break, which means this dish has met the quality standards.
When it comes to building materials, glass blocks are clearly a classic. In the 1920s and 30s, they were a cornerstone of the Art Deco style of architecture. Today, glass blocks are still popular for creating walls, windows, and stunning design features. A stylish way to build a privacy barrier that still lets in light. Glass blocks aren't just decorative. They insulate from heat, cold, and noise. Production begins with just four ingredients. Recycled glass pieces called cullet, sand, soda ash, and limestone. A computerized system portions out each one and feeds them into a melter. This giant furnace heats the batch of ingredients to a fiery 2700 degrees, transforming them into molten glass. The melter pumps out enough molten glass to make one half block at a time. Automated shears slice just the right amount. The gob of glass then slides into a waiting mold. A plunger pushes the gob down, spreading glass throughout the mold cavity. Its waffled surface imprints that pattern into the glass. A blast of ambient air cools down the molten glass drastically, from 1800 degrees to 1100 in just a few seconds. This way they don't lose their shape when a retractable arm extracts them from the mold and lays them on a conveyor belt leading into a sealing machine. This is where two half blocks join together to form a full block. Entering the machine, each piece passes over a series of burners that keep the glass temperature constant. Sudden cooling could crack or shatter the glass. The machine then slowly reheats the half blocks until their edges start melting. Next, they enter the part of the machine called the squeeze station. Here, an automated press forces a top half and bottom half together. Their melted edges fuse, forming a single block. The blocks now travel into a layer, an oven that cools the glass at regulated temperatures over several hours. This annealing process prevents cracking and allows the glass time to set properly. The glass goes in at about 1800 degrees. Coming out, it's down to 175. The blocks are now ready for inspection. Workers use digital alignment gauges to make sure both halves are flush. Then, they run a straight piece of steel along the block's surface to check for any distortion. Every block must meet precise standards for both size and shape. A 7.5-inch square that's 4 inches thick. Building with glass blocks is similar to building with bricks. You use mortar to stick them together. To prep the blocks for mortaring, workers now place each one onto a separate station. As it spins, nozzles spray the edges with liquid vinyl. This coating will help the mortar stick to the glass surface. Just one last step. An inkjet printer applies the product code along with the manufacturing date and time. The quality control department runs samples through an impact test. A worker drops a weight through a tube onto the side of the block. This verifies the strength of the sidewall and the seal between the two halves. Finally, the glass blocks are ready for shipping. Glass blocks come in so many shapes, sizes, and patterns that the design possibilities are endless. Both practical and beautiful, it's no wonder they're so popular with builders and decorators alike.
Used for windows, doors, and partitions, patterned glass panels add beauty and light to a room. But their purpose is more than decorative. The designs in the glass also obscure the view, making patterned glass an effective privacy screen. They let light in and keep prying eyes out. With patterned glass, windows become something to look at rather than through. There are a variety of designs and textures to choose from, offering different degrees of privacy. At the heart of the process are engraved metal rollers that transfer designs onto glass. Before production can even begin, this roller rotates through a chamber where grit blasts off grease and dirt. If the designs on the roller are damaged, they shave off the outer skin, exposing a smooth surface for re-engraving. But that isn't always necessary. Small problems can be fixed, so they circle those for repair. Some need no refurbishment whatsoever, so they move on to the next step. A worker brushes a polishing compound onto the printing roller. A buffing wheel rubs the compound into the roller's chrome surface, taking it from dull to a high shine. Meanwhile, in another part of the factory, craftsmen repair trouble spots on other rollers. The work has to blend in perfectly. The craftsmen do their jobs with a finesse that comes from natural skill and years of practice. One false move, and the entire pattern could be ruined. But the touch-ups are perfect, and these rollers are now ready for the production line. The raw ingredients for the glass panels are stored in huge silos. These ingredients all come from the earth: sand, limestone, dolomite, soda ash, and salt cake. Here's a sampling in a jar. Conveyor belts feed a mixed batch of ingredients to a roaring furnace. They add waste glass and recycle it into the process to reduce the effect on the environment. Fired at 2900 degrees Fahrenheit, the ingredients melt quickly. Now a molten mass, it circulates in a loop pathway. An inspector checks the melting status of the glass ingredients, as well as the flow of gas fuel to fire the furnace. This furnace is burning 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and is monitored constantly. The hot liquid glass now flows between two rollers, one of them engraved. The rollers imprint designs onto the glass and squeeze it to its final thickness. The glass rapidly solidifies, fixing the pattern in the ribbon of glass. It then travels through a 65-foot-long temperature control zone. The glass ribbon is exposed to flames to relieve stresses caused by the manufacturing process. This is called annealing. The glass slowly cools as it leaves the zone. This seals in strength and durability, so it can now be cut cleanly without fracturing. This cutter scores the glass lengthwise, but doesn't cut it all the way through. The scored line maps out the desired width of the glass. Another cutter moves to and fro to create horizontal score lines. These score lines establish the length of the patterned glass panels. Then a roller pops up and breaks the glass along the horizontal score lines. The sides of the glass now collide with little wheels known as bonkers, which snap the glass along the lateral score lines. The waste glass falls down a chute to rollers that bust it to bits. These bits are called cullet, and they'll be recycled into new glass. A worker now backlights glass panels and examines their finish for flaws. This solar glass panel has a matte finish. Compared to the small sample of standard clear glass, it's less reflective, allowing more of the sun's energy to be captured. Minerals high in iron produce greenish glass that's light absorbent. For solar glass, they go easy on the iron to produce white glass that transmits light. A carrier with suction cups stacks the glass for shipping. Now all that's left is the window shopping.
Glassmaking dates back more than 40 centuries. But in the late 1800s, glassmakers created something new. Glass that was both milky and translucent. They called it opalescent glass. Like its namesake, the opal gemstone, its beauty lies in the way it magically catches the light. Opalescent glass is a semi-transparent glass in either a solid color or a swirling mix of hues. Glassmaker is created by melting minerals, including silica sand, soda ash, dolomite, limestone, and fluorspar. Adding recycled glass helps speed up the melting process and stretches costly raw materials further. The mix is colored with pigments, in this case cobalt oxide, which gives a distinctive blue tint. A hoist then lifts the raw ingredients, called batch, to a double-chambered mixer. ingredients flow from end to end between them, thoroughly blending the batch. The blended batch now goes via wagon to the Beehive, a furnace that contains 12 ceramic pots. The furnace worker shovels the batch into a pot to melt at a searing 2600 degrees Fahrenheit. He pushes any spills back into the pot, then, to control the temperature inside, closes up the pot's mouth. 24 hours later, workers scoop out the glowing molten glass. With only seconds to spare, they hurry to the mixing table, keeping the glass in motion to prevent it from cooling unevenly on the way. It's critical they cool off the ladles between each use, or the next scoop of glass will adhere to the ladle surface. The ladles they use vary in size, holding between 4 and 40 pounds of molten glass. Workers pour as many as 5 different ladles at once to make a single color. The mixing table is where the magic happens. The table worker picks up one gather of burning molten glass, then another, then skillfully blends them together using a steel fork. He then flips the molten glass into a rolling machine, evening it out as it squeezes through the rollers. Out comes a sheet about 6 feet long and an eighth of an inch thick. Every 90 seconds, workers fill their ladles with 2,000 degree Fahrenheit molten glass. Mixing it on the table helps cool it and blend the colors. The table worker separates the glass sheet from the table surface, forcing out any trapped air bubbles and further cooling the glass. The sheet now goes into a lyre, an oven that hardens the glass, then cools it evenly to prevent cracking. From there, it's on to the trimming table. Workers wear protective clothing and thick gloves to handle the razor-sharp edges, still hot to the touch. Cutting the glass sheets is a delicate two-person job. They must work in sync to keep pace with the sheets that keep on coming. A single pot produces about 25 sheets over 24 hours. That's 300 sheets a day from just one 12-pot furnace. Using a carbide-tipped cutter, the workers score the glass, then snap apart the pieces, standard 32-inch square sheets. They set aside the excess glass to remelt in a new batch. Finally, the sheets are loaded into crates for shipment all over the world.
Around 1000 AD, craftsmen began making intricate window designs using lead rather than wood or plaster between pieces of colored glass. Before long, the church began commissioning stained glass windows depicting religious scenes to adorn the great cathedrals of Europe. You can make stained glass two ways, using copper foil, a technique developed about 100 years ago by the American artist Lewis Comfort Tiffany. Or you can use the centuries-old European lead technique, which we're about to see. First, the artist lays a plate of glass over a pattern and traces the parts of the design that she'll cut from that plate. Then she scores her trace line using a glass cutter. A quick snap and the glass separates neatly. She follows the same procedure with different colors and textures of glass, making all the pieces of the design. By running the cutter slightly inside the trace line, she leaves room for the strip of lead that will later hold the pieces of glass together. Once she finishes cutting all the pieces, she checks them against the pattern, making sure they'll fit together properly. Now it's time to assemble the pieces using the pattern as a guide. This zinc molding will frame the panel, its inner groove fitting over the edge of the glass. The artist positions this molding along the perimeter of the pattern. Then she drills an L-shaped wood frame into the work table to hold everything in place during assembly. A few nails keep the molding in place. She'll join the pieces of glass using strips of lead called came. Lead is used because it's soft enough to bend to the shape of the pieces. After straightening out a long strip of came, she cuts the various lengths she needs to border each piece of glass. The came is shaped in such a way that the glass on each side just slides right under. The cutting pliers, called nippers, are specially designed to slice through the came without deforming it. Once the artist finishes assembling the glass pieces, she pushes everything gently against the wood frame. This squares the panel and ensures the pieces fit together snugly. Now she brushes on flux, a type of acid. This cleans the lead came so that the solder will adhere well. Using a soldering iron, she applies a bead of lead and tin solder wherever two strips of lead meet. Then she uses a short bristled brush to coat the lead in black putty. This makes the seams watertight and gives the lead a darker aged look. Finally, she sprinkles on calcium chloride powder, called whiting. This sets the putty and polishes the glass and lead to a shine. After four painstaking hours, the panel is finished. More elaborate stained glass works feature hand-painted detailing. The artist first prepares the design on paper, then cuts the pieces of glass accordingly. He paints the design outline on the pieces in black, then fires them in a kiln to set the paint. To create shading, he applies a coat of brown paint, called grisaille. Using a dry brush, he removes it from the parts he wants to highlight. Then he fires the glass again. Now, he paints in the fine details and fires the glass for one last time. The paint contains powdered glass, so the intense heat of the kiln bonds it to the glass pieces. The result is nothing short of spectacular.
The main ingredient in glass is silica sand. When you heat it along with other chemicals, it turns into a syrupy liquid that you can then mold or blow into a particular shape. Add lead oxide and you've got lead crystal. It's much softer than regular glass, making it easier to decorate with intricate cut designs to enhance its brilliance. Craftsmen start with silica sand, which is a very pure type of sand. Then they add nickel oxide to help the silica sand melt, lead oxide, potassium carbonate, potassium nitrate, and antimony to give the finished crystal its smoothness, heft, and sparkle. They compress the mix into pellets. They heat the pellets for 18 hours, creating a mass of molten glass that they can call the melt. To that, they add cullet, the term for excess broken or rejected crystal. Cullet smooths out the melt. A blower now uses a hollow blowing iron made of tempered stainless steel to collect some of the melt. He constantly rotates the iron so the melt clings together in what's called a gather. The blower rolls the gather on a heat-resistant table. This sparks a flame because the table is coated with beeswax to prevent the molten crystal from sticking. The blower exhales a slow, steady breath of air to create the base of the piece called the ball. After letting it cool for 90 seconds, he dips the ball back in the furnace to coat it with another layer of molten crystal. This fortifies the ball. Now he begins shaping the ball using various wooden tools. This one's called a block. He uses another tool, a divider, to create grooves so the ball will fit into a mold. The blower soaks the wooden tools in water so they won't burn. He now inserts the ball into a steel mold, one of 150 this company uses for its collection.
The craftsmen coat the inside of the mold beforehand with a paste of cork dust, linseed oil, and charcoal dust. This prevents the ball from sticking, which would cause flaws in the crystal. The blower releases the ball, now called the bowl, using a foot pedal. After cooling the bowl for 1 minute, another craftsman called a stemmer adds another gather to create the stem of the wine glass. He clips the gather with heat-resistant scissors. He uses a wooden divider to shape the stem area and a metal divider to stretch the gather into the shape of the stem. The stemmer must be highly skilled. There's no mold or pattern to follow. He relies entirely on eyesight, intuition, and patience. He cools the stem with layers of wet newspaper. They absorb heat well and don't leave marks or flaws. Next, another craftsman adds more gather to create the foot of the glass. He uses a wooden tool called a pitch to flatten the foot. He also shapes the foot by hand with wet newspaper. This metal template ensures it's generally the right dimensions. Everything is handmade, so each piece may differ slightly. This company makes 20 models of glasses, including different styles for red, white, port, and ice wines. The piece then goes into a kiln at 840 degrees Fahrenheit. At the end of the day, they switch off the kiln to let the glasses gradually cool overnight to room temperature. The next day, a craftsman uses an acetylene torch to cut the glass and remove the cap. They use an old record turntable to spin the glass around and make the cut. For precision, they smooth and bevel the rim with a diamond-coated steel grinder. Another craftsman, called a cutter, marks out a grid with a waterproof pen. He uses another type of turntable to steady his hand as he draws. It's not an exact pattern, just a general guideline to create the design of the piece. This design's called the Titanic. It's based on a light fixture from the ocean liner. Water cools, lubricates, and cleans the area during cutting. There are two types of cutting, wedge and flat. Wedge cutting creates the deep, intricate cuts. Flat cutting creates smoother, less angled cuts. Here they use the wedge method, which can only be done with diamond-tipped wheels. Here the cutter creates a diamond-shaped grid called a Caro cut. Finally, the cutter creates a star-shaped cut spanning the entire foot of the glass. Once the decorations are complete, an inspector does a detailed quality check before etching the company logo.
Glass faucets elevate indoor plumbing to an art form. The glass is handcrafted in a range of shapes and patterns for visual effect. Metal components are fused into the glass to deliver one of the necessities of modern life, running water. Glass faucets are about both form and function. Glass faucets have a delicate beauty, but they're stronger than they look. The glass is very thick, allowing the faucets to hold up to heavy use and even abuse. A glass faucet starts with chunks of clear glass. The glass worker loads it into a furnace that's fired to over 1200 degrees Celsius. A worker selects black and white billets of glass to add stripes and patterns to the clear glass. He preheats them so the glass won't shock and fracture when exposed to higher temperatures. With a metal rod, he gathers a clump of the clear glass from the main furnace. Using this glob of glass, he collects the preheated white cylinder. He exposes both to the flames that have been heating the chamber, making the glass more malleable. Using a curved wood tool, he gathers the clear glass at the base and wraps it around the white billet, encapsulating it. He attaches the other end of the glass to a second metal rod. The glass adheres to it and stretches as he pulls it across the room. The glass is now over 12 meters long and pencil thin. It starts to cool and solidify as they set it down. He taps the glass against a piece of metal to break it into 20 centimeter long pieces called canes. They shape another piece of clear glass by rolling it on a metal table called a marver. The glassworker blows through the metal rod, causing the glass on the end to bubble. It will eventually become the faucet and two handles. He adds a layer of black molten glass to the bubble. His colleague arranges the striped canes on a grooved iron plate and heats them with a torch. The first craftsperson then rolls the hot glass bubble onto the canes, and they adhere. Then it's back into the furnace, and the white striped canes melt into the black bubble. He rolls the glass across the marver repeatedly. He pinches the canes at the top to close them around the bubble. Another reheat keeps the glass pliable as he continues to form it. He transforms the bubble into a hollow glass tube. He elongates the tube to get it closer to the desired diameter. Using a pincer-like tool, he forms the end into a round handle shape, while his co-worker aims a torch at it to keep the glass pliable. He creates a hole for a threaded piece of metal hardware. He applies a bit of molten glass to the metal hardware. He inserts the threaded hardware into the round faucet handle and cuts the handle free from the rest of the glass. Then, using a forming tool, he refines the shape. Next, he preheats a metal mold. This stops the hot glass tube from fracturing as he bends it around the mold to shape it into the faucet. Once the faucet has taken its final shape, it's ready to go into the annealing oven. It bakes the glass at a lower temperature and then slowly cools it. This removes stresses and strengthens the glass. Meanwhile, using very high pressure water with fragments of garnet, they cut trim rings from steel, as well as a display plate for the showroom. To install the glass faucet on the display plate, the worker threads a nut to the faucet valve. This showroom display will simulate the look of the faucet in the washroom. He installs the trim rings at the base of the handles, and then assembles them to the display plate, using the hardware that's been fused to the inside of the glass. He wipes off fingerprints and any smudges, and this glass faucet is ready to make a statement in the washroom. 3 days in the making, it's something very unique for the sink.
Glass lends a sparkle to any interior. From a bathroom sink to a staircase, architectural glass is both functional and artistic. The glass can be either handmade or mechanically formed. It's called architectural glass because an architect usually designs its aesthetic features and the objects the glass will be paired with. This company fuses multiple sheets of glass, each about a quarter of an inch thick, to create a finished product of any thickness. For example, this soon-to-be kitchen countertop uses 5 sheets of standard glass. Grabbing one at a time with handled suction cups, they gently place it on a pneumatically operated cutting table. They measure and cut the correct size using a square angle with a diamond-tip blade. Diamonds are the only material that can cut glass. This kiln is a specialized oven for baking glass. A craftsman sprinkles white powder onto the base of the kiln. The powder will leave a texture in the sheet of glass. Next, he sprinkles ground up colored glass across the glass sheet to give the kitchen countertop a unique color scheme. They sandwich the glass with another sheet of glass, repeating this coloring process with each of the remaining layers. Once the last sheet of glass is put in place, they clean the top surface. Now it's time to close the kiln and bake the glass. Inside the kiln, the five layers fuse into one unit. At another kiln, a stack of glass has been fused together and is ready for the next step. Workers open the kiln and carefully transfer the newly formed glass countertop onto a rolling cart. They take the counter to the polishing machine. With stones and water, the machine grinds down the edges until the layering is no longer visible. The finished glass countertop is strong enough to span over 9 feet without structural support. And because of the heating and cooling process, the glass is now scratch-proof and chip-resistant. You can even chop food directly on the surface. At a different kiln, they're making a sink. First, they use a textured glass stamp to press a pattern in the powder. Then they place three layers of glass over the pattern, carefully aligning the edges. After baking, the three layers are fused into one thick circle of glass. The bottom of the glass has taken on the pattern of the powder, leaving a unique look. This will be the outside surface of the sink. They place the glass over a sink-shaped mold in a different type of kiln. Over several hours, the glass melts into the sink-shaped mold. Once the glass cools, they extract what is now a sink. They carefully measure and mark where the drain hole goes. Then they drill the hole with a diamond bit. This generates a lot of heat, so they must continuously cool the bit with cold water. Otherwise, the tool could overheat and jam. The glass sink is finished. They use the same technique to produce glass sinks in various colors and shapes. Sometimes these sinks are even integrated with glass countertops. Countless other interior design components can be made from architectural glass.